What is so special about the people in the United States? Nothing is special. They are people just like you and me. I don't want to hear an American president ever again lecture me about human rights. Why?
100%.
Yeah, because they have been sending 2,000-pound bombs to the Israelis to bomb Palestinian children. I don't, you know, from now till the end of time, the Germans need to stop talking about human rights.
All right, this is Vijay Prashad. This man is a hero from India. He's done his homework, and when it comes to the Israel-Gaza conflict, he breaks it down with surgical precision. Vijay Prashad is an Indian historian, journalist, truth teller, and probably one of the most morally grounded voices alive when it comes to imperialism, racism, and Palestine. He's written 40 books, yes, 40, and dedicated his life to exposing how the so-called civilized West props up genocidal regimes while preaching to the rest of us about democracy and human rights. It's sickening, and Vijay doesn't hold back. This video isn't about playing nice. We're cutting straight to the core, not the PR headlines, but the actual power structures fueling the bloodshed. We're talking about how Gaza is not just about land. It's about global dominance. It's about who's allowed to live with dignity. It's about a system that treats Palestinian lives as expendable and Israeli bombs as holy. It's about how Europe and the U.S. helped build a militarized outpost called Israel and then had the audacity to call it a democracy. We get into hyperimperialism, white fragility, and why the West's moral grandstanding is nothing more than a cover for brutality. If you're still clinging to the both sides narrative, this video's your wake-up call. If you already see through the lies, this is your fuel, your clarity, your resistance. Like, comment, subscribe, and send this to someone who needs the truth. Let's go.
My family did not participate in doing a Holocaust against anybody. There's an attempt at moral superiority. Mm. Yeah. So, for instance, they will lecture us about human rights in Iran, or they lecture us about how Hamas has a bad attitude to women and this and that. Bad attitude to women. Women are dying under American bombs. Okay. You want to criticize the Iranians because they are saying, oh, you know, you should cover your hair. Women are dying under US bombs. I don't want you to tell me about how much hair should be shown or not shown. Okay. You are obliterating people's heads and then lecturing us about the hijab or about whatever. This is the moral decline. The moral decline is they still think they are superior when in fact they are participating in genocides. Again, I want to underline this. This is not an Israeli genocide. This is an Israeli, US, European genocide. I think it's very wrong to consider. Poor Benjamin Netanyahu shouldn't bear the whole blame for this. Olaf Scholz, Emmanuel Macron, Keir Starmer, before him Rishi Sunak, you know, Joe Biden, after him Donald Trump, all of them. All of them should be sitting in a prison cell in the International Criminal Court.
How did you feel watching this live stream genocide over the past year and a half? And has the level of barbarity and violence surprised you?
Yes, the level of barbarity and violence has certainly been shocking. I can't say it surprised me, but it's been shocking. It didn't surprise me because, you know, I've been as a correspondent in Iraq, in Syria, but really Iraq was a test case of this. You know, people forget that when the United States bombed Iraq from 2003 onward, it was vicious bombing. They bombed the entire infrastructure of Iraq. You know, they bombed water purification plants, electricity plants, they bombed the airport, they bombed some hospitals, they killed journalists, including Tariq Yaqub of Al Jazeera while he was on air. The violence that the United States inflicted on the Iraqis was extreme. Now, there wasn't access to the images because you didn't have the ubiquity of cell phones and so on. And also the US media was able to quite sufficiently suffocate images coming out of Iraq. So it's not like I was, you know, not expecting something like this. In 2014, the Israelis, as part of their punctual bombardment of Gaza, you know, almost every few years, 2006, 2007, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14. I mean, every year in the summertime, the Israelis went on a rampage and bombed one or the other part of Gaza. When they bombed Gaza in all those years, it's not like they didn't hit the hospitals or didn't hit the universities or didn't bomb UN institutions. They were doing it right through those years. It's just that in 2023, they almost decided to carpet bomb all of Gaza. In other words, to hit the hospitals, hit the universities, but not hit one hospital, not hit one university, but flatten all of them. And they used 2,500-pound bombs to flatten entire neighborhoods. 2014, they flattened neighborhoods in Jabalia. Mm. They flattened neighborhoods in the center of Gaza City. This time, they went after almost all neighborhoods. So it's the scale, not the actual quality of bombing. Mm. They've done this before. They've attacked, you know, UNICEF buildings and so on. 2014, they bombed the UNICEF building in Gaza. Not unusual. The quality of the bombing was the same. Bomb civilian infrastructure. But it was the sheer quantity. They bombed everything. That shocked me. So it wasn't a surprise. It was a shock that the Israelis decided effectively to just bomb from one end of Gaza to chase the people south, continue to bomb them. You know, there was a lot of expectation that by the time the Palestinian who were fleeing from Gaza City got to Khan Yunis, it would stop. But then they went up to and started bombing Khan Yunis. Then as people went towards Rafah, there was again an expectation. You remember, it's going to stop. I mean, the fact that the Israelis ignored everybody, they ignored all the governments of the world, they ignored, except the United States, because I don't believe the United States and Israel are two countries. I think they are one country. But everybody else was saying, stop, stop, pause, take care. Nothing. Not one day did they stop without wanting to wrest some concessions from somebody or the other. And there was no space for dialogue or negotiation. That was shocking.
And not only that, but they also, the Israeli soldiers, while they were killing and destroying universities and hospitals and schools, they filmed themselves doing that. And they bragged about it.
So ugly. You know, it's in my opinion, there's a concept that I very much hope people will start to use. And this is the concept of the International Division of Humanity. You know, for hundreds of years, in a period of, in a sort of context of colonialism, there was an understanding that some humans are better than other humans. You know, let's say Europeans or people who were considered to be white are superior to everybody else. Humanity was divided. And the people who were not considered to be white could be just killed. You know, the first aerial bombardment takes place against Libya in 1911. The Italians just carpet bomb the Libyans and then bragged about it, saying that our aerial bombardment is a good education for the tribes, the Arab tribes in Libya. They learned to behave themselves. 1924, the British bombed the Kurds in northern Iraq. Again, Arthur Bomber Harris writes a report saying, you know, these Kurdish tribesmen, they will learn to fear us. They're a lower form of humanity. When I watched the bombing by the Israelis of the Palestinians, it was very clear that there was an international division of humanity operating. Mm. You know, one Israeli child, seemingly, according to some calculation in Washington, D.C., or in Tel Aviv, one Israeli child is worth 10,000 Palestinian children. If one Israeli child is hurt, you are allowed to kill 10,000 Palestinians. That's the attitude of the International Division of Humanity. And the way the soldiers were displaying children's clothes, playing, breaking toys, and the cruelty, you know, that cruelty, you can't even say it's excessive. Because if an International Division of Humanity is operating, it's normal to treat the children of the savage with absolute contempt. And that's exactly how the Israeli soldiers were behaving. They treated Palestinians as savages. And this itself has to be considered not just a war crime, but this is beyond that. I mean, it's somehow even the term genocide seems too little. This is something beyond that. This is a crime against civilization.
Yeah, I wouldn't say that it's only Israel who treated the Palestinians as savages, but also most of the West, because they have enabled and participated in this genocide. And that actually takes us to another aspect of the conversation today, which is a report that your group authored recently. It's called Hyper-Imperialism. So we'd like to talk a little bit about hyper-imperialism. But before we go there, can you, in your own words and briefly, describe to us or define to us what is imperialism? What is the global South and what is the global North?
Yeah, you know, this is an old concept, imperialism. Effectively, what imperialism refers to is a structure in the world where certain people, either a minority group of people as nations or a group of nations, oppresses the majority of the world, treats them as subhuman, takes their resources and sells them finished goods. Mm. In other words, continues to benefit by the subjugation of other people using their labor, their resources and so on. That's imperialism. Mm. Imperialism is something that we experienced, you know, during the British colonization of large parts of Africa, Asia, French colonization of large parts of Africa, some parts of Asia, so on. I mean, in a sense, after the collapse of the Ottoman Empire, the totality of Palestine was colonized by the British and was held as a so-called mandate. Palestine was in British hands and north of Palestine in French hands, the French mandate, including what is today Lebanon. Then the extraction of resources and the use of other people's labor at lowered cost, that's imperialism. Mm. You see, we live in a slightly different period than the classical imperialism. Mm. Why is that? Well, some countries, particularly in the post-World War II period, centered around the United States, began to mute their various differences. So the Europeans muted whatever differences they had with the United States, and they created a bloc. Mm. That bloc has a military alliance. Mm. The military alliance is the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, created in 1949. That bloc has a very important intelligence alliance called the Five Eyes Network, which includes Canada, United Kingdom, Australia, New Zealand, and the United States. That was created in the 1950s. Now it's an 11 Eyes movement, includes some European countries. In 1974, these countries created a political economic group, which was the G7. Mm. It was, you know, Italy, West Germany at the time, United Kingdom, France, Canada, United States, you know, and Japan. These were the G7 countries. So if you take the military alliance, the intelligence alliance, the kind of political guidance coming from the G7, this group becomes the global north. And this group actually unifies policy and starts to act together. Now, we calculated military spending by this bloc. Mm. The NATO plus bloc, that means the NATO countries plus a few allies like Japan and South Korea, if you include their total military spending, it's 74.3% of global military spending. Mm. You know, people think, oh my God, China is becoming a major threat to the world. China's military spending is 10% of the global total. Russia, 4%. It's this NATO plus country with the United States as the major spender on military arsenal. This is the real threat to the world. And Israel is a part of this bloc. I mean, I'm very much of the view that the debate that has happened over many years, you know, is the United States directing Israel or is Israel directing the United States? This is a debate we should stop having. The fact is, the United States and Israel are one country when it comes to the Palestinians. They operate hand in glove. If you start thinking that they are not hand in glove, you will get confused. Mm. When Joe Biden would say, well, we're trying to tell them to have a ceasefire, but meanwhile, he's shipping 2,000-pound bombs, What he's saying is merely to confuse the world. In fact, they weren't trying to get Israel to have a ceasefire. There's no evidence of that. You know, Blinken will travel to Tel Aviv 10 times during the conflict. But okay, when the Ansarullah government in Yemen said that, look, we cannot any longer tolerate weapons going through the Red Sea and going to help Israel kill more Palestinians, we're going to stop that. United States government didn't bother with any diplomacy. They didn't send Blinken to Sana'a to go and talk to the Ansarullah leadership. You know, there was no diplomatic overture. They just threatened the Yemenis and then they bombed them. You know, so look, in that sense, the United States was bombing Yemen on behalf of Israel.
Yeah.
Where is the space between these countries? So we generally think of this global north as a pact, as a bloc. Germany, with the United States, supplied almost 100% of Israel's weapons. Yeah. United States about 80%, Germany close to 20%. These are hand in glove. Britain provided a small percent, but still very sophisticated equipment to the Israelis. They are hand in glove. I don't imagine that it's useful to continue the debate and discussion whether there's any difference between Berlin, London, Washington, and Tel Aviv. I think they are part of a bloc, which we call the Global North, and they treat those who are on the other side of the International Division of Humanity without any care for their life, for decency. There's no care and concern at all.
That actually explains the situation very well. But my question to you, why is Israel so special to the West? And the West doesn't only support Israel militarily, but also diplomatically with media. It is very much part of the West, part of the North, of the global North. Why is that so? What is so special about Israel?
I would like us first to go to something a little absurd. Just the other day, an Israeli football team was playing a match in Amsterdam where their supporters arrived in the city and ran riot, tearing down Palestinian flags, chanting offensive racist things, and then instigating a fight against the supporters of Ajax, the team that was there. What was an Israeli team doing playing in Amsterdam? Well, Israel plays in the European League. But by the way, for people who don't know this, Israel is in fact in Asia, is not in Europe.
Yeah.
Secondly, Israel participates in Eurovision. Israel is part of Asia. It's not part of Europe. But the Europeans see Israel as a garrison, a European or a white garrison that is out there like a almost like an aircraft carrier in the Arab lands. They see Israel as part of them. And I'm saying this now with an understanding of the kind of racial or racist metaphysics that colonial ideology produces. Israel is Europe in Asia. There are so many quotations to this effect made by Israeli leaders saying that, you know, we are a European civilization, we are a European bastion surrounded by Arabs. These are all racist formulations. You know, to call Israel a European, part of European civilization is absolutely ridiculous. What does that mean? Is it or is it not part of Asia? If it's part of Asia, it's not part of Europe. But they don't mean this geographically.
Yeah.
The reason Israel is part of Europe is the same way Australia is part of Europe. Australia also participates in Eurovision. This is a racist metaphysics. These are white countries. And I don't think this should be underemphasized. They support Israel because it's a white country fighting against people that they think of as dangerous barbarians. And I know I said this before about the International Division of Humanity, but I really feel like this gets underplayed and underspoken about in the analysis of the genocide against the Palestinians, that there is an enormous attitude of racialist white supremacy that operates here, and a kind of assumption in European and North American countries that somehow the whites of Israel have to be defended against the browns of the Palestinians. And that repulses me, that that is what gives license to Israel to slaughter tens of thousands of people, including tens of thousands of children.
A new report titled Hyper-Imperialism, a Dangerous Decadent and New Stage, there's a quote that I would like to read. You say, it is not a matter of exaggeration to say that the global north has declared a state of open hostility and war on any section of the global south that does not comply with the policies of the global north. What do you mean by this hostility and war on the global south? And where do you see Palestine fits into this?
So to make the point, let's go to Cuba for a minute.
Yeah.
I just published a book with Noam Chomsky called On Cuba.
Yeah.
In the book, we make the point that the reason the United States is obsessed with this small island with only 11 million people, less than the people in New York City. The reason the United States is so obsessed is that the Cuban Revolution has been defiant. That's a word that the U.S. State Department uses. It's Castro's defiance that they don't like. That's how they say it. And they are worried that that defiance will become contagious. So therefore, that defiance has to be destroyed. And the way to destroy it is to do a blockade against Cuba for now almost 70 years. Palestine is actually right in this storyline. It's very interesting because you could make the argument that when the Palestinian leadership, which had been quite isolated in North Africa, you know, having been removed from Beirut after the Israelis invaded Lebanon in 1982, the PLO had to leave, go to North Africa, were very detached from the Palestinian, occupied Palestinian territory. You know, when the first Intifada happens in 87, the PLO was really not able to understand what was going on. Their links were not as tight and so on. At the time, they go towards the agreement, which we then know as the Oslo Agreements, 1994. Well, you would have thought that after 1994, after what Edward Said called the Versailles of the Palestinians, a kind of surrender, that the Israelis and the global north would have said, well, there's no more defiance. The defiance has ended. And in fact, it is to some extent true that there was a little truce, that the PA was allowed to establish itself, particularly in the West Bank, not really in East Jerusalem, which the Israelis were convinced they would annex at some point. They had land on it, built universities and so on. And Gaza was also a kind of expectation that maybe they could settle things there. Remember, they had settlements and so on in Gaza. What happens subsequent to that is that there were enough factions of the Palestinian resistance movement that did not accept Oslo. You know, some of these were of the left, but there were also groups like Islamic Jihad, Hamas, and so on that rejected Oslo. And it's their defiance that makes this idea of Hamas so central to the imagination of the West. Subsequent to the Hamas winning the Legislative Assembly elections 2005, that's when the bombings start of Gaza. You know, it's to actually snuff out defiance by Hamas. They defied not only Oslo, but they defied the global north. Now, this doesn't mean that it's about Hamas. It's about defiance. And it's so interesting that the West linked Hamas to Iran very early on. You know, regardless of the West's stereotypical attitude to the Middle East, where they say, well, Shias and Sunnis don't get along. I mean, Hamas had nothing to do with Shiism. You know, it comes out of the Muslim Brotherhood tradition. It was largely getting financing from Qatar and Turkey. There was really not much Iranian influence at all on Hamas. But the United States put together all the elements of defiance in the Middle East, Hezbollah, Hamas, you know, Iran, all in one place. And all that defiance had to be killed off. Later, when Ansarullah comes in, they say again, it's an Iranian proxy. I mean, now, Mr. Netanyahu is conducting what I think of as an act of gaslighting. He wants, and he's been trying desperately, to turn the genocide against the Palestinians into a war against Iran. Mm. He wants everybody to think that what the Israelis are doing is not murdering Palestinians, but protecting the West from a defiant Iran. That's his gaslighting. That was, I think, the reason why they go to Iran to kill a Hamas leader. They go and murder Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, who was, in fact, you know, one of the most beloved leaders in the Arab world for the fact that he had resisted against the Israeli occupation of Lebanon, a legal resistance, and had defeated the Israelis. In fact, twice. Once, by forcing the Israelis to leave Lebanon in 2000, and secondly, by not being defeated by the Israeli war of 2006. The murder of Nasrallah, the killing of a number of Iranian generals to try to provoke Iran into a war. And Iran has been extraordinarily disciplined, knowing that entering into this conflict actually benefits Benjamin Netanyahu because the United States will come and clobber Iran. So, you know, this idea of defiance, that which is why they want to say, look, we have nothing against the Palestinians. We just want to erase Hamas. But in fact, here's the crazy thing. If you just want to take out Hamas, why are you bombing civilian buildings at night? Because then you're killing entire Palestinian families. If you just want to go after Hamas, stop the aerial bombardment. Send in your military. Fight house to house to get to the Hamas people.
Why do you think they kill Palestinian civilians, entire families?
Well,
because, what is this justification behind this logic?
That is, I think, something I've already mentioned, but I think it's worthwhile putting it together. I think they are focusing ideologically that they want to eradicate Hamas because this is the logic of getting rid of defiance. Mm. That's what Israel is telling the West, because the West cannot tolerate defiance. The attack on Cuba is similar to the attack on Hamas along those lines. Don't permit defiance because defiance can be contagious. Okay. That's what they're telling the West. But what in fact the Israelis are doing is pretty straightforward. They want to clear out Palestinians from Gaza. Look, I've said for a long time, for over 10 years, that Israel will never permit a one-state solution. A one-state solution goes right up against the Israeli idea of the Zionist state. They know that if in 10 years the Palestinian population increases above the Israeli Jewish population, that the idea that Israel is a Jewish state is going to not work. They'd have to accept a binational, plurinational, in fact, because, you know, there will be Armenians and a whole other bunch of peoples. Mm. You know, it would be a plurinational state of if it's a one state. That is unacceptable to the Zionist hardcore leadership. A two-state solution is largely impossible because, you know, the settlements in the West Bank have eaten the territory. East Jerusalem is almost completely annexed and they are now emptying Gaza. What the Israelis want, in fact, is a three-state solution. That's what they are going for. And the three-state solution is Lebanon, Jordan, and Egypt.